From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Among the reams and reams of paper confiscated by investigators during the Watergate era, there also were about 500 reels of Super 8 home movies. There wasn't anything particularly incriminating in that film. Mostly it was frame after frame of jittery, out-of-focus images revealing life behind the scenes during the Nixon presidency. It was shot by three Nixon aides, and the filmmaker Penny Lane has taken all that film and constructed a narrative, a documentary of found footage. It's the latest film in our series, Through the Lens, and it's been getting a lot of attention lately. Today in the program, Lane will join us to talk about her documentary, what these everyday and ordinary images reveal about one of the most tumultuous times in American history. Our Nixon, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What's intriguing about Penny Lane's new documentary film, Our Nixon, is how utterly ordinary all the footage is. It's Super 8 home movie film mostly, so it's often badly lit and out of focus or kind of jerky. But the reason the documentary works is, of course, the context, the fact that these images were shot by some of the most notorious players of the Watergate era, Nixon presidential aides H.R. Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, Dwight Chapin. They were all convicted, of course, of various crimes in the Watergate cover-up, and for 40 years, their home movie, some 500 reels in all, stuff they shot aboard Air Force One or during junkets or at the White House gatherings, they were all put in a vault where they were mostly forgotten. And Penny Lane has now stitched this film together with other archival images and interviews. The whole film is made from found footage, really. It's an unconventional portrait of the Nixon presidency in one of the country's most tumultuous times. The film's been getting a lot of attention, and we've chosen it to begin our new season of our new documentary series, Through the Lens. This evening at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, we're screening the film. Today in the program, we're talking about it, and Penny Lane is joining us. We invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Penny Lane is the director and producer of Our Nixon. It's her first feature documentary. It premiered at South by Southwest, won Best Documentary at the Seattle International Film Festival. Her shorts, video art, and essays have been screened at festivals throughout the United States and around the world. She's also an assistant professor of art and art history at Colgate University in New York. And Penny Lane, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I guess we should start with like the time you found out there was all of this Super 8. Like when did you first learn about that?
So in, I think it was in 2008, I was at the Flaherty Film Seminar, which is an annual film conference that I go to. And I met this guy, Brian Fry, who is now the co-producer of Our Nixon. Yeah. And I think within the first couple of days of meeting him, he mentioned that he had heard about this box of home movies at the National Archives. And I think, like most people, I was instantly interested. I mean, I have found that people are like, oh, really? Like, and he said, oh, I always wanted to make a film out of it or something, but I never really got around to it. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't let it go. I was like a dog with a bone. So I kept saying to him.
Why? Wait, why?
Well, because what you were saying before about how Super 8 home movies they're kind of boring. I mean, I know that because I've seen a lot of home movies. Yeah. I've worked with a lot of amateur film footage before, yeah, or at least watched a lot of it. And I've always loved home movies, but they're really banal and they're very difficult to do anything with artistically in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Unless you have an in. You know, you look at your own home movies and you're like, oh, right, that's the day that this happened and you care, but most other people's home movies you don't. So it seemed like a really, and I think that most people get this right away, it's an interesting way to think about home movies. They're not what we usually think of when we think of home movies, and because they are amateur films that have this very big, dramatic, historical context around them, it seemed like it would be a great platform or a great way to kind of show people how cool home movies can be without having to sort of be totally bored by them. I mean, they're still pretty boring. You know?
Yeah.
Like, amateur films are amateur films, you know, and I teach filmmaking and I teach amateur filmmakers all day and the films are not always that good, you know. So I think that, and also I think that there is this promise when you hear about the fact that there are these home movies that you've never seen, there's a promise of revealing something new that you hadn't seen before. And so we knew that there'd be something new there.
Right.
And we had a sense of what the home movies might feel like to look at, but we really didn't have any idea what really we would get out of it or what kind of film we might make with it. But anyway, so Brian and I decided to collaborate in this project. And you know, the home movies weren't classified or anything.
No.
They were just sitting there and you had to
there was this impression that they were locked away.
And it's not an impression that we've tried to, tried to create, but no matter how many times we tell people that there's a big difference between declassified and just like sitting in at the National Archives.
Yeah.
When we say vault, we mean like climate controlled, you know, archive, not secret government vault or something. But yeah, so there is a sense they've been like clandestine. They're not at all, but they were just more just forgotten, I think, because they don't do anything as far as furthering our understanding of Watergate at all. And not just because of historical interest, but because of law, the National Archives had to process and release the material that they confiscated from the Nixon White House in the order that was most relevant to the ongoing investigations about Nixon's involvement in Watergate. And so these were put to the bottom of that pile pretty early on.
Yeah.
Because they don't do anything in that department.
So, let me just go back to what it is that interests you about like found footage in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at, like most of us look at, if we don't get who, like, if we don't know who that is, or we don't know what's going on, they're boring to most of us. But you find it interesting. Why? Because you're trying to figure out the story behind it, or you create a story in your mind behind it. I mean, it's like collage artists, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They take these found objects and they make something out of it. So either it's real or it's – I mean, is that how you're thinking about it?
I think it's all the above. I mean, I've always been very attracted to found stories or found objects or found, you know, footage or what have you. And when I look back at all the stuff I've made, it looks very varied, but that's always been part of it. And I think part of that is that I just – well, it's two things. You could go in terms of my kind of what I enjoy doing. I don't enjoy putting cameras in people's faces.
Yeah.
I think that's rude and like weird.
Wow.
And I
– Says a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I just – you know, and it's not that it's a bad thing to do. I personally don't enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
I feel really bad doing it. So early on in my kind of career, I sort of was like, oh, I noticed that I was so much more willing to accept the challenges that come with found footage than to accept the challenges that came with creating my own footage. And that's like a whole set of things that has to do with control and lack of control and what kind of control you want as an artist and what kind of control you find is better to let go of. I like chance a lot. And then when it comes to some sort of more intellectual things about found footage specifically, I just find that I like mystery. Mm. I like to make films I like to make films where you're not wrapping everything up and explaining everything. I don't want to explain everything. And there's something just so inherently mysterious and unknowable about found images. You never really know what's happening. You know, you didn't make them. So you don't know what the person was thinking when they filmed it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, I just like that feeling. I liked sitting and watching the home movies and really initially having no clue what I was looking at. I mean, I didn't know who Dwight Chapin was. I didn't know what he looked like.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell the difference between Dwight Chapin and Ron Ziegler. I mean,
they all kind of look alike in those days.
A little bit,
right?
Yeah. And in a good way, though.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
They look good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was like, oh, they look like Mad Men guys. Like, they really were.
They really were.
I was like, here are the real Mad Men guys.
Yeah.
With the beautiful, brill-claimed hair and nice suits and everything. And then you look at the hippies and you're like, they didn't look that good. So initially I think that Brian and I both just were like, yeah, we don't know anything. What's going on? Who knows? It's so fun. And obviously that's not the feeling that the film produces, but that was very fun for us to just engage with mystery like that.
Yeah. Before we I don't want to give people an impression that this doesn't have a kind of historical context or a narrative to it. We're just talking about how you got started. So I'm trying to imagine you get something on the order of like 450 reels of Super 8 movie videos. And what? You just put them on a projector and you just go over them and over them and over them. And you just look at them and you just, and you're like, and you're looking for what? Like, is there a story here? What can I build with this? Because you didn't want to create a false narrative. I mean, there this is an incredibly important historical event. But you, so what are you looking for?
I think that we were just looking to find out what what we felt was new in the footage. You know, we knew, like I said before, we knew there'd be something new because it's never been seen, but we didn't know what that would be. I think we initially thought what a lot of people think, which is that the home movies would be more revelatory in terms of Richard Nixon, that he would be closer to the camera, that you would see him with his socks off or something.
Yeah.
And there's really none of that. I mean, this is really, I mean, and it makes sense, obviously, once you think about it, like you're an aide to the president. You're not like shooting, you know, you're not like following him around like shooting Super 8 film with him. He's always kind of at a distance and he's sort of over there behind a wall of advisors. And what you really get is a very kind of rich and sympathetic and warm portrait of the staff. So it was pretty quick that we were like, you know, this really is really about the guys with the cameras. This is less about Nixon than it is about the guys with the cameras. And as you were saying before, the footage is really poorly filmed, which is what that does cinematically, is remind you that there's a person holding a camera.
Right.
Constantly. There's never, you can't ever forget that there's a person holding the camera, because the second you do, they drop it, or, you know, they zoom in this awkward way, or they do the fire hose thing where they like film all over the place. And, you know, so you couldn't take the footage as kind of B-roll and just be like, oh, here's some footage of Nixon. It's always footage of Nixon from a very specific point of view. So that was what we were starting to feel from the home movies. That and two other things that ended up being a big part of what kind of film we made, which you're right, it's a narrative, you know, it's a narrative, really. It's like tells a story in a very clear way. It's not like you're like, what's happening?
No.
But the two things that we realized were going to be important to the film, besides the fact that it was really going to be about these three guys with the cameras, was one, there was this kind of warmth and this kind of closeness and intimacy and kind of brotherhood and love and, you know, this kind of feeling where you could just see it, like they were so excited about what they were doing. And, you know, that produces this kind of painful, sometimes funny and sometimes sad, dramatic irony where you're watching them and they're smiling and they're you can see the story they think they're a part of.
Yeah. This is before they're villains, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and I think that's what's so interesting about it is, and maybe, I think you said this at some point in an interview, that it was one of the most surprising things about it, is that I think a lot of people of a certain era, like I'm thinking baby boomers, John Ehrlichman is a villain, hard and fast. H.R. Haldeman, a villain. Crew cut. You know, he was Nixon's SOB, right? But that's not the perspective that you come to in this film, which is, I'm not sure if that's going to disappoint some people. It's not. It just sort of humanizes them. And I think what's interesting about it is it's a new form, or it's a new way of coming at this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't have any, neither Brian nor I had any particular, we don't have a dog in this race, okay? Like, this is not my, and I wasn't even alive when this happened.
Yeah.
We had a great deal.
Did that free you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We had a huge amount of distance from this story and from this material that I know really affected the way we made the film. It's not that I didn't know anything about Richard. Come on, you know, like, but, you know, we're reasonably educated people. And of course, we now know everything because you do research when you make a film like this. But the goal was not one day I woke up and said, I have something to tell the world about Richard Nixon and Watergate, and let me tell you it.
Yeah.
The goal was really to engage in an artistic process and find out what could be learned and what was interesting and what felt new and what felt fresh. I'm very sensitive to films that just repeat the same thing over and over. And I've watched every Nixon documentary, and they all have the same clips in the same order, the same talking heads saying the same things. And we were just like totally allergic to that. We were totally committed to the idea that we weren't going to use the same 2 minutes of White House tapes that everyone's already heard, and that we were going to try to find something new. And I know we did that. And I hope that most people come to the film with knowing all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like most people come to the film having heard like the tape where they say the cancer in the presidency or, you know, whatever. So we know
because they've all seen them too.
Which is also really freeing, right? Because you don't have to cover all the bases. And to the extent that someone would say, film is incomplete. And you're like, well, yeah, it's really incomplete. Like, you know, we're not retreading that same, we're not making that same 4-hour Watergate documentary you've already seen. We tried to not even go to Watergate. We were like, everyone knows about that. We'll just make a film about the time before Watergate because that's what those home movies are. It's like this little bubble that gets burst, right? And so initially we tried to just make the whole film in that tense, like in that present tense moment before Watergate happened, but the film didn't really make any sense. And I think audiences didn't trust it. Early test audiences were like, hey kids, like, do you not know
where you're going with this?
No, like they thought that they think we didn't know about Watergate because we didn't like say it in the movie. We were trying to be like coy and like people will just think about it on their own. And it's like, no, people need to know that you know this before they're willing to go down this road.
Yeah.
Because you're right. It's a really, I think people are very surprised by the way that the characters emerge. And it wasn't, again, it wasn't an agenda. It wasn't like we sat down and said, everyone's got Haldeman wrong. Let me explain. You know, it was more about providing a kind of more nuanced, like sort of just new view that could not supplant but add to what we already know about these people. Not to take away the sort of known criminality of that man or something, but to sort of see the world from his perspective for a while, which I think is a really important exercise intellectually, but also as human beings, it's just really important that we remember that they actually are people. And even Richard Nixon was a person. And anyone who has ever spent any time listening to those 4,000 hours of White House tapes, mm-hmm. as I have, can attest to the fact that Richard Nixon was just a person. And that is terrifying. You know, it's really scary. And, you know, I think that's why we hate him so much. It's not really about the crimes he committed. It's about the fact that he inflicted these tapes on us and forced us to see the president of the United States as just a person who could be petty,
profane.
Yeah, petty or profane or confused or, you know, bigoted or tired or drunken or any of those things, which I'm sure every president has been all of those things at some point. It's really disturbing. We'd rather them not be people.
When did you realize you had a film? When did you realize, oh, I think this could work?
Oh, I think we thought we had a film from the minute we had the idea for the film. What the film would be was a big question. Whether the Super 8 films would lead us in the direction of a feature documentary or whether they would lead us in the direction of something that was a little bit more experimental that would show in like art galleries was a big open question.
Yeah.
The point at which we decided that we had a feature documentary was about 6 months into the project. Once we started doing all the archival research and realized how much material there was in terms of interviews with our three characters, because without those interviews, we couldn't do the story. We couldn't really make the characters emerge from that Super 8. They're silent films, you know, they're there, but you're like, okay, you know, there's Dwight Chapin smiling. Doesn't tell you very much about him, but to see his face and to hear his voice, and especially to see those three men age over time, I found very interesting. So once we found all those interviews, because there are two of them have passed away and Dwight Chapin is not involved in the project. So for us to have make the film be a film that had like kind of a traditional story structure where there's like three men that you actually care about and get to know and then their downfall matters to you on some level emotionally, we couldn't have done that without the archival interviews.
Yeah.
So that was the point at which we figured we had this feature doc.
It's interesting. I mean, it's not about Richard Nixon. It's about the three men.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the way the three men were. Is betrayed too strong?
I think they were betrayed. I mean, that's not the word. I mean, to be clear, it's not a word that Dwight Chapin uses, for example. John Ehrlichman did very clearly feel betrayed. He said it often and loudly until he passed away in the 90s. And again, Haldeman didn't say a negative word about Richard Nixon, you know, ever until the day he died. So to be clear, like when I say betrayed, that's my point of view.
Of course.
There's a little bit of an imposition of our point of view. I absolutely got to the point in sort of doing all this research and reading the memoirs and listening to all these interviews where I just felt very strongly that that, yeah, they put their belief in him. And whether he betrayed them because he's a jerk or because he made a mistake, you know, that's not my call. But it's absolutely true that they put their faith in him. They gave their lives to him. And he betrayed them by making a lot of bad decisions, by giving a lot of bad orders, or whatever happened. I mean, again, not...
By just sticking his nose in everything.
Yeah.
So that was another big thing.
Yeah.
Which we'll get, we'll come to
yeah.
And when we get back from a break. I want to say something about... There were these moments in the... film that I really loved just because they were so completely not banal but completely ordinary. Like, I'm just imagining John Ehrlichman outside of his office filming these chickadees or these birds or whatever wandering around and squirrels. There was a shot of that somebody had took because they, I'm not sure which of the three took it. They found it funny that there was some horse manure at a parade ground after the president. You know what I mean? Just these really small moments in the backdrop of this incredibly big thing that was going on. That was really interesting.
Yeah, thanks. That was one of the things that we thought was important about the home movies was that they were so human and that there were these little moments where you could sort of feel like, I don't know, someone's sense of humor coming out or, you know, or someone just sort of, yeah, what someone would zoom in on. This is always an interesting question, right? But yeah, sometimes it's horse manures, but often, more often it's the American flag or the presidential seal, which they could not zoom in on if they saw it anywhere.
Right. Penny Lane is with us. She directed and produced Our Nixon. Tonight at 7 o'clock, we're going to be presenting a free screening at the Rose Wagoner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. Of course, it's part of our Through the Lens partnership with the Utah Film Center. Penny is going to be with us for a Q&A immediately following the film. Doors open at 6:30. Arrive early so you can get your seat. For information, just visit us online at radiowest.kuer.org. If you have questions or comments, you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are beginning a new season for our Through the Lens documentary series. The film we've chosen is Penny Lane's film, Our Nixon. It has been getting a lot of attention, premiered at South by Southwest, the film festival there. It won Best Documentary at Seattle International Film Festival. It's been in a number of festivals. We're screening it tonight at the Rose Wagoner Performing Arts Center at 7 o'clock. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Penny Lane is here with us in studio. She'll be there tonight as well for a Q&A after the film. It'll be interesting to see how... reaction from people. How are people reacting to the film?
It's so fun. I think that it's been more or less like really, it's been, first of all, very surprising. I thought this film was a bit weird and that a lot of people wouldn't get it or sort of just think, okay, what? It's like all found footage and I don't understand. Yeah. Or it doesn't have this kind of political agenda. Yeah. So it's a film that sort of looks like it's about politics, but it sort of isn't. And, you know, there's a lot of ways that I feel like it's very surprising. And so, I completely accepted the idea that not many people would really like it very much. Yeah. But it turned out to be wrong, which, of course, is always a nice thing to be wrong about. I think what I like about the responses we've gotten is that the fact that it's actually a really kind of fair movie in terms of it's quite humane. Again, it's not a hit job. It's not your sort of typical Nixon documentary where it's like there's these evil people and here's the good guys like Ellsberg, you know. And so I think you can come to the film with any number of different perspectives on this story and still have an interesting experience with the film. So it's not – so in other words, if you think that – you know, Richard Nixon is a great president who was widely misunderstood and was taken down by like a left-wing press, which is a point of view many people have. It's a film you can watch and have that point of view throughout it, you know, and it's and if you think the opposite is true, it's a film you can kind of enter as well. And either way, I think people find that they're a little bit they're a little bit provoked or a little bit challenged, but also like get to have their point of view not completely invalidated. So I think that that's the thing I like about the film. The response to the film the most is that people have been demonstrating that the film does function well in that way. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make a film that really anyone could enjoy. Also, Nixon aficionados or, you know, people that don't know anything about Nixon, we wanted to make sure the film would be interesting to both those categories of people. What I also really like is that people that hate it and think it's really biased equally.
What, against Nixon or whatever?
Well, equally come from, you know, the kind of way far left and the way far right. Yeah. Like, so we've been accused of, like, doing a hit job on Nixon by people like Ben Stein, which I think
former Nixon speechwriter.
Right, which I think is hilarious in the sense that it's, like, so far from a hit job. It's, like, the nicest movie anyone's ever, sorry, but it really kind of is, like, the nicest movie anyone's ever made about Richard Nixon. And then, but also, you know, people have been like, this is an apology for these like terrible men and how dare you try to make them human beings. They're not human beings. They are devils, you know? And I'm like, well, that's ridiculous too. So, you know, so to me, it's been really gratifying that the negative responses we've gotten in terms of people accusing us of being biased have come equally from those. That's great. Like what could be better?
Yeah. Let me ask you, I want to ask about, I want to play a clip from, that's hard to give people a sense of the film just through the clips, because the film is this, yes, it's an aural experience because you hear these clips, but it's, again, it's that found footage that people in the radio are not going to be able to obviously see. So we're a little limited in that sense. But I wanted to play a few clips from the film. One, and it's a fairly ordinary sort of moment here. This is Dwight Chapin. One thing that's really interesting about the story of Chapin, the story of Haldeman, even Ehrlichman, is they're not that old. You know, I think they come to us, our impressions of them is because they were part of this, you know, kind of dowdy, you know, conservative establishment.
Dull gray men,
right.
Yes.
But Chapin's 27 years old.
When he walks into the White House in 1969, he's 27 years old. And he's been working for Richard Nixon since he was 19. So, I mean, that's a, you know, 8 years already he's been working for Nixon at that point. But yeah. And Haldeman and Ehrlichman were a little older. They were in their early 40s at that point, but again, had been working for Richard Nixon since they were much, much, much younger. So yeah, there's a way that you think of them as being old, and maybe that's partly because of how old the baby boomers were at the time where they were demonizing them, you know? So yeah. Like, they looked so old to people who were 22 in, like, you know, 1972. But then now you look at them and you're like, yeah, they were pretty young, actually. Yeah, they were young. And I think Dwight Chapin, especially in our film, kind of stands in for that feeling where that kind of innocence, you know, what does he know about how the world works? He's a kid, you know, and he comes to D.C. and he puts on his suit and he goes to his exciting job at the White House, you know, and he doesn't know the future at all.
A typical day for me, Haldeman would pick me up around 7:15. The car would get Bob. Then it would get Larry Higbee, Bob's aide. And then it would swing by my house, and they'd enter the White House. I am responsible for the scheduling and also for the president's daily activities. Our thing was a machine, and I knew my place. It really reflected a lot about Richard Nixon, the degree to which he wanted things controlled.
It's interesting. And then Ehrlichman, of course, he mentions just right after this moment in the film how all-consuming the job was.
Mm-hmm. Like 15-hour days every day of the week.
Pace unremitting, which I'm sure if you work in the White House now, that's what it is now.
I'm sure.
Typical. I mean, but this idea of control, and this is where you start, where the narrative for the film starts to kind of take hold. At least it did for me.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that they're all in, they're sort of fresh-faced, and they have this idealism related to the world, which is remarkable and interesting too.
Mm-hmm.
And through it all, they're shooting these crappy home movies. And it was into, like, I think.
But they weren't crappy at the time, remember? This was like, Super 8 home movies were like the coolest, newest thing, right? It was like iPhone 5.
So this is
5.
Like their iPhone, right?
This is an iPhone 5. That is the coolest thing you could possibly have. It was like Kodak put out the Super 8 cameras in 1969, which is the year they came into the White House. Sorry, I interrupted you. But yes, they're crappy home movies now. But at the time, they were like state of the art.
I actually was interested in that, is how people are going to make, like, what would be the difference between seeing that then in light of today, you know, reality television mm-hmm. and the fact that anyone can, you know, shoot a video or whatever on their iPhone or
yeah.
iPhone for that matter.
I don't know. I do think that, you know, it's funny to me, like these guys being like the Nixon people, the Nixon White House, they have this like bad rap where it's like, well, why were they filming so much and why were they recording so much? And I'm just like, I mean, that's what everyone I know does. I don't understand what this yeah. confusion is. Like people right. are so amazed by it. And I'm like, well, I literally put 6 photos on Instagram a day. Like, I don't have any problem understanding why they were filming. I would have filmed. Like, I mean, of course, now you wouldn't be allowed to, duh. But at the time, yeah, more innocent time, I guess.
Yeah. We hear some raw and rough audio of Butterfield. I'm trying to think of his first name.
Alexander
now.
Butterfield.
Alexander, of course. And yeah. he's the one who reveals to the Watergate committee that there are these tapes. And
yeah.
that's when the story blows up. But he's talking, there's this tape that you include in the film where he's talking to the president, and I think Haldeman's there too, about this White House taping system.
Yes, it's the very first tape. It's like the one where they've just installed it and they're talking about whether it works and how it works. And yeah.
But Butterfield tells the president that there aren't very many people who know about it. It's hard to hear. I'm not going to try to play it because it's really tough
yeah,
to hear.
Yeah, we subtitled it.
Yeah, we did. But Nixon says, mum's the whole word.
Yes, yes. Which is a great phrase, mum's the whole word. We tried that out on the movie poster once as a tagline.
Is that right?
It didn't work, but we liked it. Mum's the whole word, yeah.
But it's interesting. I mean, he is... He says, I want just this just in my file. Mm-hmm. What do you think this reveals about Richard Nixon?
Well, I think that, you know, again, I think that there's a great deal of kind of like confusion around those tapes, I think. And people tend to conflate the White House taping system with like the other issue of wiretapping and, you know, spying on people and these things that happened that came out later that we now know were completely illegal. The White House tapes were fairly benign. I mean, Richard Nixon taped himself. He didn't want to have someone in the room taking notes during his meetings. He wanted to be able to have his private meetings or his private phone calls, but also have a record for history, for historical purposes. LBJ had the same taping system. Kennedy had some tapes. It wasn't like some, you know, it turns into this sort of like Nixonian, you know, you're like, well, it literally was not that a big deal at the time. Obviously, it became a very big deal. And then, so for me, I love listening to that first tape because it's sort of like they don't really say what the purpose is. And there's literally a point where Nixon says the whole purpose is, but then you can't make out
yeah,
what's on the tape.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like the whole purpose is like unclear, but which I think is kind of funny, but I guess part of it, what I love about that scene also is that you can hear Nixon, he doesn't understand how it works and they're trying to explain to him how it works. And
yeah.
and he's just totally like technically inept. And it, to me, it's quite funny in a subtle way where they're like, and he's like, but the system says off. And they're like, no, it doesn't have an on and off. Like,
yeah.
because basically I later found out they knew that he was too technically inept to operate a system. That's why it was an automatic taping system
yeah.
because they didn't think he'd have the wherewithal to be able to like turn it on and off properly. So they just put a locator on him. And it was, again, this kind of like love of this like technological solution. You know, they were like such techie guys and they were going to like solve this problem with modern technology.
Let me play a clip. This is and I love this part of the film, too, I have to say, is, again, it's not it's H.R. Haldeman, who's been dead for many years now, a conversation with Mike Wallace. And throughout the film, we see these interviews, just portions of them, the things that you found. Again, and it's part of the kind of whole found tape conceit in many ways.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. Here's H.R. Haldeman talking to Mike Wallace.
Why didn't you burn the tapes?
Surely you talked about it.
Well, the question came up at one point, should the tapes be destroyed? And my strong recommendation was that they should not be destroyed.
That was a mistake, wasn't it, Mr. Holmes?
Yes, sir. I would say that given what we now know and what's now happened, that it was a disastrous thing to have done. But there was never a thought that one word of those tapes would be played in public or be played to other people. And when it got to the point of having to release them, or having even to consider the possibility of releasing them, they should have been, in my opinion now, it should have been destroyed.
How did you come away thinking about H.R. Haldeman? Like, from your initial impression? I mean, again, he is, I think he's the darkest figure for most people for Watergate is H.R. Haldeman. It's because of the crew cut, and he looks like an SLB, you know, or most people think he does.
Once he gets rid of that crew cut, though, he looks like a totally nice
guy,
right?
Kind of does, right? Yeah, it's an awesome 70s haircut that he sports, you know, before all
later
that.
Later in life. But I think that he's a really interesting person, and he's extremely difficult to get to know. He's the most frustrating subject I've ever worked with as a filmmaker.
Really?
Because he doesn't like storytelling. Yeah. He likes facts. He likes data. He likes lists of things, and he likes systems.
And he doesn't like hyperbole.
He does not respond well to hyperbole. You can't use a colorful metaphor with him. He'll just say, well, no, let's go back and, you know. And
he even rolls his eyes at one point.
Yes, it's very frustrating to deal with him as a subject because he's so kind of anti-narrative. Like, he resists stories. And he also doesn't like emotions, and he doesn't show emotions in a kind of obvious way. And so, but what I came away from, but I spent, you know, years with this guy in terms of reading his books and reading his diaries and listening to his tapes. And he kept an audio diary in the White House and listening to those and everything else. And I actually think that he is incredibly misunderstood. I'm willing to go out in a line and say this. There's a kind of way that people think that they look at that interview with Mike Wallace and they see someone who's stonewalling or is like sort of the sort of slick used car salesman. I see someone who essentially is, I mean, kind of like, I don't know if I want to say it this way, but kind of on like the spectrum, you know, like he's just like in this kind of like systems, like he's not showing emotion because he's not feeling it and he doesn't understand why you are kind of, you know.
Yeah. This is who he is.
This is really who he is. And if you look at, you know, it's consistent like throughout his whole life. He's not someone who is known to be kind of a lying SOB. He was just this kind of rock of a man who doesn't break and just is obsessed with like making the system work correctly and getting the facts right. And he kept these incredible, you can see it all throughout his character. He kept these incredibly detailed logs of every single thing that happened every single day. I mean, he would work his 15-hour day and then he'd go home and sit down with a dictaphone and recount in great and boring detail every single thing that happened that day. And he would write it down, and you'd see that they're completely consistent. Like, everything is like, so the kind of dedication he had to Richard Nixon, I think, is confusing to me, to a lot of people. I think he had this kind of company man attitude where he was just like, I've committed myself to this person, and that's what I did. And he was happy to be a number two man.
Yep.
He didn't want to be in the limelight. He wasn't Kissinger. He wasn't even Ehrlichman. He didn't want anyone to interview him. He didn't want to be famous. He didn't really seem to want power, per se. He just was so committed to this idea of being like the number two man in a way that is completely mysterious to me. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm taking away, again, from his role in the misdeeds in the White House. And that's always the risk I run when I start rambling on about these things. I sort of take it for granted that your listeners know that stuff. And all I'm doing is kind of like looking at it from this kind of slanty angle from over here, and no one had ever really spent any time really trying to explore his character in any way, and so we tried.
I want to play a clip. This is phone tape again from the Notorious tapes. This is Richard Nixon and Haldeman, and this is so interesting. It's after a speech that Richard Nixon has given on Vietnam, and they're talking about the speech. And what I think is interesting about it is how Nixon is looking to Haldeman for this affirmation. I mean, he's bragging about it. Nixon is too. That's interesting. And Haldeman's going along with him. A lot of just a role that – and Nixon is so thin-skinned about people. You'll hear talking about people who criticized it. You can tell how thin-skinned he is. And Nixon is always looking to Haldeman in the tape that you use in the film to say, hey, check it out. Find out what are people saying. It's kind of creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And Haldeman will play that role. Here's another moment from the film Our Nixon.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
That was great. Now, I must say that I put an awful lot of emotion into it.
Well, and
I don't know whether it got through.
It sure did.
The last part, of course, was quite a work of art, to be frank with you.
It sure was.
To take all of that and to put it, compress it into that, and to say it without being maudlin, and yet to have some emotion in it. You know, it was done with style.
It sure was. The calls, you've talked to him, and did you talk to the vice president?
Yeah, I talked to him, and of course.
Billy Graham?
and Graham. I talked to those three because I felt I should. Rockefeller called, well, the hell with him, but nevertheless. But it was a goddamn good speech.
It
touched people.
That thing is coming through, all the way through.
You want to give me a little rundown?
Sure. O'Neill at the New York Daily News said, it's the most effective job you've done yet. National Reviews were impressed with the statement, courageous and absolutely necessary, adequately answered the critics, but retained the flexibility you'll need in the months ahead. Sacramento Union said, the best and most effective presentation he's made. It will really get through to the American people. It was honest and sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And George McGovern didn't like it. He said it hadn't changed anything.
That's great. Didn't want him to say anything. Well, what the hell? Doesn't make any difference. As I say, tomorrow, we'll just live through the day, and we've heard from only three cabinet officers, which I expected. And
more than that.
No, that's all. Rogers, Mitchell.
Mitchell, Rogers, Hodgson.
Haven't heard from Connolly, though. That's curious.
Not to my knowledge, no.
Why don't you call him and ask him what he thought of it?
Sure.
All right.
Okay, you want me to call you back then?
If you would, yes.
Right.
I love how raw that is, you know, and I love how he's like, why don't you call people and tell them? What do you think that reveals about Richard Nixon? I mean, there is that impression, of course, that he was incredibly insecure incredibly thin-skinned.
Well, I mean, he might have been. Here's what I think. I think we don't have 4,000 hours of tapes of any other president. So it's very difficult for me to ultimately say, oh, obviously, look at how insecure he is. I mean, I don't know.
We might all be that way, right?
I don't know. When I put something on Twitter, I'm like anxiously seeing if someone liked it all day long. So to me, it's sort of like, I think that there's a way that we have this need to make Nixon this kind of like exception to the rule. Like we need for him to be the only president who was ever fill in the blank, you know, criminal or depressed or drunk or whatever, or insecure or thin skinned. I mean, I listen to this and it is hilarious. Like I laughed my butt off. That's why we put it in. It's like, to me, I couldn't believe it. And this is, you have to realize, a condensation of like a 3-hour conversation. I mean, this is like a 1-minute cut down version of what went on for actually 3 hours. Like just going over and over. Well, it was really good speech. Oh, but so-and-so didn't call, you know, and it's like over and over. And Haldeman's just like sitting there and he's like, yes, sir. The whole time he never says, get over yourself, like, you know, go to sleep or something. So I don't know what it reveals about him other than I relate to him, like I would probably do the same thing if I had just given a really important speech on like national television. But maybe you shouldn't be that way if you're going to be the president of the United States. Maybe he really was like so insecure and so thin-skinned, and that maybe was a big problem for him. I don't know.
Let's take a call. Okay. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Thad is joining us from Salt Lake. Thad, hi.
Hi. I was curious, in all of the research that you did for this, did you get a sense that a lot of the things that happened in the Nixon White House that we now look upon as being rather dastardly, that there was, you know, that there was a lot of planning going on? Or do you think that they just had these random things that were going on that they were dealing with, and then all of a sudden they were just in way over their heads on a lot of issues and just had to deal with it once they were drowning, basically?
That's a great question. And again, you know, I'm perfectly happy to accept uncertainty, and I don't know necessarily, right? Like, I'm not necessarily someone who can say, I know for sure. My impression from spending years with the kind of personal testimony of these three men, who are the guys who I spent time with, Haldeman, Earthman, Chapin, and some of their other compatriots, like Bill Sapphire wrote a wonderful book, and things like that, is that they really, when that question is asked of them, they are extremely consistent in saying that it was the latter, that they were working 15-hour days, that there were 15,000 things piling up all around them all the time, and that they basically only ever had time to deal with whatever was on fire that day. And so they more had that kind of that feeling of like the latter. Like the idea that this in retrospect looks like a bunch of plans to them is very laughable. Like to them, it's like just a huge disaster that we want to make into a conspiracy because we want things to make sense. But from their perspective, they never, like when they say, I don't know what happened, I think they...
And which Haldeman does.
Yeah,
say.
And it's so frustrating. And Mike Wallace like looks like he wants to murder him because he's like, of course you know what happened. I don't know. I mean, I sort of feel like maybe they're lying. Maybe they're all lying. And there was like some kind of grand conspiracy. And thank God we caught them before it got worse. But they were all consistent to this day, and they still are, all those guys who worked in that White House, in terms of saying it was more like just a giant mess.
Fat thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. We need to take another break. Penny Lane is with us. She directed and produced Our Nixon. Tonight at 7, we're presenting a free screening at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. You should come. If you want to get another perspective on a story you've heard over and over again, you really should see Our Nixon tonight. It's part of our Through the Lens partnership with the Utah Film Center. Penny is going to be there with us after the film for a Q&A. I'm sure she wants to know what you think about it. You'll have questions for sure as well. The film is going to start at 7, though the doors will open at 6:30, so you may want to get there early for a seat. All the details are on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are continuing. It's our first of 2014 in our Through the Lens documentary series. We're talking with Penny Lane about her film Our Nixon, which we're screening tonight at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We hope you can join us there at 7 o'clock. Penny's going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get the details on radiowest.kuer.org. So you weren't even around when all of this was happening, you mentioned. So
no.
You sort of come to it with clear eyes. We were talking a little bit about this off the air. There's a kind of people who did experience it, who did live through it, who maybe protested the Vietnam War, because mm-hmm. that's always plugged into this,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of trauma that they've gone through.
Yeah, and I think actually people who supported Nixon went through the same trauma in a very different way. I think that I was very naive. I will totally admit this. When we started this project, I did not know that for many people of like a certain generation, you know, these issues, these names, these even just hearing John Ehrlichman's voice or something, like it makes their stomach hurt still in like a very real way. And it makes their blood boil and it makes their skin crawl. And so for what seemed to me like what interesting history, you know, that I could see sort of with distance, you know,
yeah,
is not that way for a lot of people. Which isn't to say that, I mean, I think that a lot of those people really love this film. So it's not like there's a disconnect that isn't transcended. But I did not know when we started that this would be such a live issue for so many people. And I would say that it's a live issue as much as it is for people who had sort of hated Nixon and thought he was like, you know, the worst thing that ever happened, and his actions traumatized them so much. That people who supported Nixon, who voted for him and who put his signs on their lawn or, you know, mm-hmm. wore his buttons or whatever. I mean, think about how they would feel. So like that kind of trauma and that kind of betrayal, it was so deep and so traumatic, and I don't think I fully grasped that until really getting pretty deep into this project. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about, there are a couple of remarkable moments, just things that are so odd. Like there's this conversation between Ehrlichman and Haldeman and the president about the television show All in the Family, and
mm-hmm.
he's talking about how, as Nixon puts it, they're glorifying homosexuality, and they're talking, and that's so odd and so kind of surreal. That's a strange moment. There's this moment where John Ehrlichman is talking about it's things are really bad, and he's talking about how they're on this flight, and he's in the flight deck, and he says just for a moment he thinks, I could crash this plane and kill the president and kill myself and kill and everyone else. And then this would just be gone. I mean, that's a remarkable moment.
Yeah. And he was a pilot, you know, in World War II. So he could have crashed the plane as well. Yeah. That's a very striking moment to me. That gave me goosebumps when I heard him say that. And I read that also in one of his memoirs.
And then there's this moment I want to play because it seems just an excerpt from it. This is Nixon saying goodbye to Bob Haldeman. It tells him to keep the faith. And now this is after he's, mind you, asked for his resignation.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, from Ehrlichman's perspective, he's betrayed them.
Yes. Yes, Ehrlichman feels that he was given, that if the president of the United States tells you to go break into a bank, you know, and like open that vault because there's things in the vault that are important for the national security, that your job, by definition, is to do it. Unless, you know, some whatever, I guess, like some ethical reasons.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that from Ehrlichman's perspective, absolutely. He was very upset that he didn't, that Nixon did not pardon him and everyone else, because from his perspective, he just did what he was told.
Yeah. Here it is, Richard Nixon and H.R. Haldeman from the film Our Nixon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hope I didn't let you down.
No, sir. You got your points over, and now you got it set right and move on. You're in right where you ought to be.
Well, it was a tough thing, Bob, for you, for John, the rest, but goddammit, I'm never going to discuss this son of a bitching Watergate thing again. Never, 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 never. But interesting thing, you know, we haven't heard of the only cabinet officer that is called is Kaffweinberger, bless his soul. All the rest, you know, are waiting to see what the polls show. But let me say, you're a strong man, goddammit, and I love you. And I, you know, I love John.
Where?
All the rest. And by God, keep the faith. Keep the faith. You're going to win this son of a bitch.
Absolutely.
I don't know whether you can call and get any reactions and call me back, you know, like the old style. Would you mind?
I don't think I can.
I agree. I don't.
I'm an odd spot to try and do
don't
that.
Don't call a goddamn soul. The hell with it.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah, like,
even after he's sort of betrayed him and he's saying, hey,
well,
could
he
you
just,
make some
he
phone
just,
calls
he just,
for
he
me?
He just made a speech in which he fired Haldeman, okay, like on television. And then he's like, can you call around and get some reactions?
Gosh.
And Haldeman has to be like,
That's probably not a good idea.
You did just fire me. I mean, you also have to realize that Nixon is obviously very drunk in
very
that
drunk,
call.
He's,
you know, it's really, it's as much as there's some humor in that tape, it's heartbreaking. I mean, the man has just fired like his best friend. And the most loyal person he's ever had in his life, you know, his partner in this enterprise for, at that point, oh my gosh, 15, 16, 18 years. And he's so reliant on him that he can't even see that you can't ask that person to call around and get reactions. And so it's funny, but it's sad, and it's just, it's pathetic. And it's just really human to me. It's a very human moment. The minute I heard that tape, well, the minute Brian and I heard that tape, we knew that was going to be the end of the film. It was so sad. And also, our film is this kind of slice of it, right?
Yeah.
It's not sort of like this big picture Nixon documentary. It's really about these, the sort of 1969 to 1973. It's like very specific.
Yeah.
It's like the moment Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Chapin walk into the White House is when it starts, and the moment they leave is when it ends. And, you know, you kind of can fill in the blanks around that in terms of what happens before and after. But I want to say something about those tapes, too, because there is almost 4,000 hours of tapes. And one of the things I realized right away when I started listening to them, once I realized these were going to be a part of the film, which obviously in the radio, it seems like that's the whole film. You could have a radio doc, right? It's just the tapes because they're really interesting, was that I'd only ever heard, you know, like maybe 3 minutes of them out of like 4,000 hours all these years later, 40 years later. We're still kind of like... So I started listening to all these tapes and I started thinking like, oh my gosh, there's so much, it's so rich. I mean, as an artist, you're like, these are funny and they're weird and they're very humanizing. Like I said before, they're very humanizing. I found the tapes to be much more humanizing than the home movies, ultimately, in the sense that you really do feel like you're just hanging out there and things are being discussed. I'm just surprised that more people haven't caught on to how interesting those tapes are until now.
Penny Lane, she directed and produced Our Nixon. Tonight at 7 o'clock, we're presenting a free screening of the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City, part of our Through the Lens partnership with Utah Film Center. Penny's going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You may want to arrive early. It all gets underway at 7. The doors open at 6:30. Go to radiowest.kuer.org for the particulars. Penny Lane, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.